Welcome to VentureCast number 22. I'm Craig Severson of Grunt Media.
I am David Hornick of August Capital.
This will be the magic show because 22 is a very important number in numerology.
Is it?
Yes, it's a master number. And with Pluto on the ascendant of your sixth house, David, I think if you cross water, you will meet with great fortune.
All right, but I should just tell you, I only have one house. When you buy one house in Palo Alto, that's all you can afford.
That's all you get.
That's all you can afford.
Yeah. House or a garage.
We were just talking actually yesterday about what we could have done with all the billions of dollars that we've spent on this war. And I said I could dig a basement.
Yeah.
Which would be, right. You know, so I could have a bedroom for all my children.
Yeah, exactly.
That didn't seem to be what they were talking. They were thinking, you know, research and for the clean
silly,
tech and
silly
stuff
government
like that.
Stuff.
I was thinking basement.
Yes, exactly. Basement in Palo Alto. So it's been a couple of weeks. Has it? Or yeah, we're on schedule.
I think we're doing back. Good.
We're back on. We're back in the swing of things. And what have you bought lately? you buy any companies? Or the other question is, Web 2.0, bubble or bust?
Right.
How many talks have you given on that?
I have not bought anything. You know, but this is funny. You know, I met with this entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
People keep saying, oh, it's too late and there's all this money and everything's too late and you can't put money to work. And so I sat down with this guy, a friend of mine told me this is a really great, smart entrepreneur. He has a good idea. It's super early, so it would be putting in kind of angel investment. Do you even do that? I said, sure, I do that. If it's an interesting idea or whatever.
Right.
So I sit down and he kind of describes his idea. It's in the advertising space. It's a great idea. He's onto something really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's fun. It's not being done. I mean, you know, here's my $500,000.
Yeah,
it's like a no-brainer. And so this idea that there's nothing interesting to be done, the web thing's over, and it's so crazy competitive that, you know, all the angel investors are in charge of the universe.
Right, you don't need that much money to start up a company.
Well, you know, smart entrepreneur is doing something cool. I hope that I get a chance to fund it early, and if it works out, then it'll be an interesting deal. So I think that welcome to the venture world. It's basically you got to be opportunistic and look for things that are interesting, and if you find them, then you know you might actually make some money.
Well, so I mean, this is a discussion that's going on a lot. Is the venture world in general more open to these smaller things? Was typically a venture deal was. I mean, we've talked about this, like, you know, 10 million or, I mean, there's no fixed number.
I think the answer has got to be yes. I mean, I think, you know, look, it's not that August would never do them. Actually, we've done them a lot over time. Mm. But I just think at this point, there are certain ideas that you have to embrace early. And maybe because it takes a relatively small amount of money to figure out if it's a really bad idea. You may not be able to figure out if it's a good idea, but you'll certainly be able to figure out if it's a really bad idea for $500,000 or $1 million. Then do that,
right?
Because the worst case scenario is you've invested $1 million, turns out it's not a good idea. Well, guess what? You know, we invest in things all the time that don't work, only usually we've invested 5 or 7 or 8 or 12 million bucks.
Now, there's a time issue, though, too, right? With VCs, there's expectation that you'll be with them in the company a bit or be on their board or...
Yes.
Right, so you can't overdo that.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, you have to decide, are you going to continue doing the things that you ordinarily do?
Yeah.
And be, this is the difference between an active investor and an inactive investor, right? So, yeah, August is almost always an active investor,
right.
And I'm almost always an active investor. And that means I sit on the board. And so, yeah, it takes more time, and you can only be on so many boards, right? I
mean, yes.
It'd be interesting to hear what various people up and down Sand Hill Road thought was the appropriate number of boards.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's some who would probably say, oh, 5, mm-hmm. which is a pretty low number. And there are others who are on 15, which is... a really high number, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at it, let's say you have a board meeting per company per month.
Per month? Do some do that?
Yeah, most of my companies have monthly board meetings.
I would say per quarter would be a lot.
Per quarter is when the things are getting more mature and everything.
Really?
But early on, things are changing quickly and you want to try and be helpful. And so, you know, if you have a board meeting per company per month, and how many work days are there? There's 5 times 4, 20.
Yeah.
And you're on 15 boards, it means you have a board meeting...
almost
3 out of 4 work days. And it doesn't even work out that way because the schedules don't really work. And so you end up having a couple board meetings, you know, twice a week for every week. And, you know, so I think that's very tough. On the other hand, it certainly can handle more than 5 boards without feeling like you don't have the capacity to be helpful. So that's definitely true that, gating item or a factor that controls the number of companies you can be involved in is time.
Now, is there, how do I put this? Some board meetings are obviously harder than others. And I guess the age of the company has no effect on that. I mean, an older company could have issues that the board requires attention on.
Yes.
Just as much as a young company can.
But as a general rule, the more mature the company, the less direct involvement, except around extraordinary events, right?
Mm-hmm,
and those extraordinary events are basically
M&A.
A change of leadership. Mm-hmm. There's a CEO stepping down or new CEO being hired, or M&A or IPO,
right?
Big events where occasionally you're doing a big deal or whatever. But basically, in later stage deals, things are moving apace, and unless there's one of those large events. Whereas in early stage deals, there are all sorts of things. You know, you're recruiting new team members. You're trying to figure out the market. You're trying to engage with customers and all of those things. And all that takes time. And if you're a good active investor, you're trying to be helpful in all of those arenas. And so, yeah, you have board meetings that have lots of issues, but more importantly, there are lots of ways in which you should and could be more helpful to the company before and after the board meeting. And so if all of your companies are brand new companies just getting started and figuring out their business or whatever, you know, six boards is a lot of boards.
Yeah.
If they're all been around a decade and moving towards IPOs or feeling stable or whatever, you know, and you're on six of those, you could do another six boards. So,
and soon you'll be off of those in theory.
In theory.
Yeah, once the IPO or the merger or the acquisition.
Sometimes, you know, you stick with it, right?
I mean,
my partner Dave's been on the Microsoft board for 25 years or something, and it's because it's a great board to be on. You get to see all sorts of things.
It's great on the resume.
Yeah, it's good. Right, exactly. You know,
how big are boards? Is that part of the bylaws?
It is in the charter for the company, and it is determined by the company, and it is usually with early stage companies, it's a negotiation with the investors to determine what's the appropriate number of board members. You know, sometimes it's how many founders are going to be on the board, how many investors, and then do you have some outside members to even things out? And you pretty much always want to have an uneven number of members on the board, because in the very, very, very rare circumstance where you actually have to vote on something, helps if you can have someone break a tie.
Yeah. Right.
I'd say in early stage companies, it's kind of five board members.
That's all.
As they get a little further down, seven. You know, public companies have a number of board members, but the role of the board member in a later stage public company is very different.
Like what with Microsoft? What do you think?
It's a lot of governance. It's overseeing.
How many people?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Publicly available?
It is. We could find out. While we discuss this, I'll see if I can find out what the answer is.
It brings up an article that I was just lamenting that I don't have on me right now, but the journal had a front page article in investments recently on this issue of being a board member as a venture capitalist. Did you happen to see that one?
You know what? I did not.
It was sometime in the past couple of weeks. And now I can't mention names because I don't have it in front of me, but a gentleman who's a part of a San Francisco investment firm, they were talking about his profile where he invested in company A. He's also on the board of company B. Company A's business starts to lean towards what company B is doing, but it wasn't originally that way, right? Because, you know, these things are volatile. And so they're just talking about that whole, you know, how companies are putting in certain policies of how do they determine if there's a conflict of interest going on and that kind of thing. So it's
true.
It can happen.
You know, this the sort of classic example of that in the Bay Area tech scene is that Mike Moritz was an investor in Yahoo.
Yes.
And he was an investor in Google.
This was mentioned.
There was a period of time when Yahoo was talking about buying Google and didn't. And then there was a period of time when Google became larger and sort of more powerful and ultimately clearly competitive with Yahoo.
Right.
And then Moritz needed to decide which board he was going to be on. He stepped off of the Yahoo board. They stayed on the Google board. And then he recently stepped off of the Google board because, among other things, there were some challenges being an active investor in the online space and having one of the potentially largest acquirers or the largest competitors as another board on which you sat. So it's certainly the case. I mean, you know, frankly, go even further back. There was a period of time when Draper Fisher Jurvetson had investments in two of the largest online email companies. And I think Tim Draper was on the board of one and Steve Jurvetson was on the board of the other. And I can't remember whether it was Tim on Hotmail and Steve on 411 or whether it was the other way around. Doesn't matter. Clearly competitive. And they said, look, we have a Chinese wall and we don't talk about it.
Right.
These are great investments. So we're going to move forward. as a general rule around here, if there's some potential conflict, we then stick with the company in which we've invested.
Yeah.
If you happen upon a conflict over the term of the investment, you know, that's a trickier problem. And, you know, if it's sufficiently acute, then I think you have to step off of one of the boards or the other.
Now, is there a problem if you're on the board of company A, but you have an investment opportunity with company B? Is it okay to go with company B and then you just stay off the board? Would August do that, or do they even?
Yeah, no, we tend to take the view that it is better to err on the side of
caution.
Of caution.
But there's no regulation around that.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think that you need to demonstrate your fiduciary duty to the company on which you sit on the board. And that may mean not investing or sitting on the board of another one, but it's an ad hoc decision.
Yes,
and,
okay.
And not the sort of thing where they're very clear rules or
whatever. No, having worked in heavy IP protected areas like at IDEO for so long, and we started to have this with these different companies as a consultancy and a very broad consultancy, lots of Chinese walls started to come up. And we were very careful about observing them because you just had to. Like, one team couldn't talk about their project publicly.
Hey, you know what Ford's doing?
Right. You know what we're doing
with
these guys?
Chrysler team.
Right, exactly. And it was just like, no, you can't do that. So it became interesting as the company got bigger. It was like maintaining that level of these Chinese walls that you're talking about.
Well, I think, you know what, an area that this is interesting, increasingly interesting, or maybe it's not interesting at all, only to me as a former lawyer, but what's happening in the law firm world is that smaller firms are merging to form bigger firms, and bigger firms are buying additional firms because there is this general sense of the value of having big multinational practices that cover everything that a client might want, etc. But as each time you buy one of these new companies, you have these conflicts, and it's a challenge. And you know, I've had clients in the past where I've said, oh, this is potential conflict, and I've asked other clients to waive that conflict and in writing say, I don't view there's a conflict. I remember one instance a client said, no, forget about it. You're our attorney. Don't.
Yeah.
I was like, you should waive it, really, because I'm going to, don't worry, it's fine. And they said, no.
Yeah.
And that's that. You know, it's not.
Right.
In that instance, it is a client-based right, and they don't waive the conflict. You know, you're playing with fire if you ignore that kind of behavior. So,
right.
So, by the way, I have the answer. The answer is 10.
10, okay.
So 10 board members.
It's still not huge. You know, it's not like 20-some.
Nope.
Which would be unwieldy, I guess. Hard for a conference call.
It's an interesting crew. We've got Mr. Ballmer and Mr. Gates. We have recently joined Reed Hastings,
Chairman
and CEO of Netflix. Yep.
Awesome.
We have Jim Cash from Harvard Business School.
Great name for a business guy.
You know, yeah, right, exactly. The former chairman of AT&T, got the former chief financial officer of J.P. Morgan, you know, president, chief executive officer of Merck. I mean, it's just, John Shirley, who's the COO of Microsoft. So it's not like, we picked up this guy.
Right. This guy's selling coffee out in Seattle.
Yeah,
he had really good ideas.
Yeah, well, you know, that guy's on a lot of boards, that coffee guy. What else?
Aggregate Knowledge got funded. I read somewhere.
Yes, well, they certainly did to the tune of a lot of money, I believe.
Yeah, good for them. Congratulations to a former joinee of VentureCast.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. Mr. Martino.
Yes.
Who's a great, smart entrepreneur.
And
there was no question he was going to raise money and raise whatever he needed. And, but it's just interesting. I mean, this idea of wisdom of crowds, you know, the idea of applying the aggregate knowledge of all of your consumers to figure out what behavior makes sense.
Yep.
You know, you see it with aggregate knowledge and a company that's competing with them called Lumia. And then, of course, you know, StumbleUpon's really using that in the background to show you the next interesting thing across a whole range of things. And obviously, Amazon is probably the most successful company at demonstrating. I mean, how often do you get the, hey, David, you might like this. And then you go, ooh, I would like that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. Yeah,
I'll buy pots and pans.
They definitely nailed the reputation system thing.
And you know, a lot of it is about just scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have enough people and enough data. And data is just so powerful. I just love data.
Yes.
Have I told you how much I
love data? No, tell me how much you love data.
The data stuff, I just love that.
Yeah.
You know, Tickle, where we had just, I don't know, billion plus questions answered by consumers, and we had the ability to help predict what behavior would track across people who answered a particular way about how they felt about cheese, or I mean, maybe it wasn't quite that specific, except when selling cheese. Yeah. I mean, it was just amazing to think that the more data you have, the more you can leverage it to predict consumer behavior or influence consumer behavior or whatever. So I think that increasingly advertisers are going to be looking for this stuff. And so therefore, the aggregate knowledges and Lumias of this world, you know, are in a great position.
Yeah. Congrats.
Yep.
To them.
So this well advertising deserved. World, boy, have you been, I mean, just.
Oh, I'm definitely keeping my eye on it.
It's on fire. Where's my advertising company? I need to sell it.
I know. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose in many ways that's what VideoEgg is, right? It's become this network, video network, but it's really an ad network that serves on into these consumer networks, into the Bebos and High Fives, whatever, on top of video and ultimately other widgets. So, you know, hey, listen, you advertising companies, I'll take $1.7 billion for VideoEgg.
Yeah. Yeah.
$1.8 billion, maybe.
No, wait, you're going the wrong way.
No, I'm just saying.
Oh, you're going up already.
It's crazy.
You rethought it.
It's madness.
Yeah.
Got 24/7.
Yeah.
DoubleClick, and then the big DoubleClick competitor, Microsoft, $6 billion dollars for those guys, and
$1.8 billion's a bargain.
$1.8 billion. I'm telling you, VideoEgg's growing fast. It's awesome. I mean, I think that, and it makes perfect sense, right? Ultimately, nail down traffic, nail down understanding, creation of media, and creation of attention and eyeballs. Now comes advertising. Bang, got to figure out how to do a better job of serving ads and managing ads and controlling ads. And so obviously lots of the consumer companies that I look at are looking at those questions. And then distribution and advertising connected, the, you know, companies that are doing that well, obviously are going to do a great job. So
yeah, it's a huge shakeup. I mean, you know, as we're working on new media and, you know, we're seeing all the different distribution platforms. In a sense, like most new technologies, we worked out the geek part. Like, we've got all these distributed ways of getting media out there. And now we're thinking about, okay, now I need to pay for it.
Yep.
Right. And so in advertising, it's starting to, like, do that implosion, explosion sort of thing. Of like, we've got, you know, they have to rethink how they're getting their message out.
Yep.
It's a very exciting time, really. It's a big shift, really, is from, like, okay, we've got three networks. We've got these publishing houses, and we'll just send huge chunks of money to them. It's not that way anymore. And those of us in the smaller media realms, you know, we're frustrated because we're too small to get their attention. So we need to aggregate in some way. And then that becomes another network. It's like, wait a minute, there's got to be a different way. And I think there will be. But it's going to take a lot more work on everyone's part, on the advertiser's part, to find places to put their money. And, you know, for all these individual people to be professional enough to attract those advertisers. And then finding the metrics.
Yep.
And yeah, and the dirty secret is the metrics haven't been all that great. Anyway, I mean,
but you know, the flip side of that is TV's never had any metrics.
Well,
it's got a pass. You know, it's like,
well,
we advertise on TV because we always have. Well, how's that working out for you? Well, we don't know, but we
don't
know.
But we can't stop.
Well, how's the internet thing working? Well, we know it doesn't work well because we measured it.
Yeah.
Okay, wait, stop.
Yep.
You know, go measure television. And by the way, you know, we've done an incredible job in this industry of figuring out how to make online advertising work and demonstrably work. I mean, that's the real change, a real shift that has rejuvenated the online media space from the late 90s to now the approaching late 2000s, is we figured out how to make really effective use of online advertising. Right? Mm-hmm. That's just an astonishing change. So anyway, but it's going to be an ongoing issue where small guys need to aggregate or need to figure out some unique space, and the big guys have a lot of control. And, you know, it's why these endpoints, you have Yahoo bought it, Right Media, you know, you have all of these big endpoints buying their own media properties, their own advertising properties to try and drive more control of the ad experience, end-to-end ad experience,
right?
Which makes perfect sense.
Right.
So I don't blame them for doing it. I think it's smart.
Yeah. And there's also, together with that, I also contend there's going to be a whole new different way in which we need to approach advertising and how we consume it, and how we, as certainly us as producers, deliver that to our audience. Like the eyeball tracking of websites, as the web medium has progressed and matured, eyeball tracking of banner ads is getting such that now people aren't looking at them. We've tuned them out. The dancing bear is no longer so interesting, right? It's like you look at a web page, you just go past the ad. So even even that is becoming not as effective as it used to be. So there are ways that I'm very interested in is how I can work with my audience, which I know more intimately because I'm not that big, with the advertiser and really make it work. I mean, really make it work in a two-way thing for both parties. That to me is what's exciting, is that we're not going to abuse our listeners anymore or our viewers anymore.
That's right, you listeners.
We're
not abusing you.
Yeah.
Zip it. God. Who asked you?
I hear my head now. I hear voices. Stop it.
So I made the mistake of stepping into an Apple store.
Oh. Did you have your credit card with you?
You shouldn't step in an Apple
store. No.
Well, here's why I had to step in the Apple store.
Mm.
My power cord somehow got frayed and it wasn't working.
The magnetic cord?
Yeah, the magnetic cord. Have you ever had that happen in a single Mac power cable? I've never had this problem.
A frayed cord at the end?
A frayed cord based on...
I'm afraid I did. In a previous one, I did.
You did?
Yes.
All right, so maybe it's just... I've just never had this problem. So had to go buy a new one. And then while I was there, I decided that, you know, the laptops that have been kind of falling apart in my boy's room. So I bought a mini. The mini is just such
a great little machine. Yep.
So relatively inexpensive, mm-hmm. powerful, you know, you get the screen, boom.
Just about to be upgraded, so good timing, David.
I know.
You didn't call me again.
No, I heard that was the case, but I just didn't, you know, you just can't.
I know, you can't, it's true.
Particularly when you're, you know, you're in the Apple store and you got, you know, money burning a hole in your pocket.
It's just burning.
And then, of course, while I was there, I had to buy an Apple TV because they were there.
They were there, and they're quite attractive, and they're the same size as the mini. And
now, I have to admit, I did use my faculty discount.
This is why
I teach my business school class. So I can get my Apple discount.
Don't you have to go to the Stanford bookstore for that?
No, you can go to any Apple store. However, the discount is like I got $20 off the mini.
Oh wow.
I got 10% off the cord. And then
sales tax.
By the way, it turns out you get nothing off of the Apple TV because apparently they can envision no academic use.
Hey, I watched a list of podcasts on it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I did. I hooked it up, and you know, I got an HDMI cable, and I hooked it up. Oh my God, that's so awesome!
Yes,
boom, done.
One cable,
it just comes on perfectly clean. The signal's beautiful.
Yep.
Setup was basically easy, but basically, it's a connector for your
iTunes.
For your iTunes,
yes,
it's an iTunes connector plus a hard drive.
System
so you
11
can cache.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cache your stuff
on
the hard drive, and then you push it. On the other hand, it's pretty cool. Like you can watch movies, and you can whatever you have on your iTunes. You can listen to music now.
Yeah.
So I think that if Apple's goal was to make the easiest possible experience mm-hmm. for pushing stuff from iTunes to an endpoint that is a television mm-hmm. set,
they did it.
Bing, they win.
The streaming works well for you. Have you done that? It worked fine. Yeah,
totally fine.
That's
I've been hearing everything, and you couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that's over Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
that's
on N. I'm sorry, I'm geeking out.
No, that's fine. But no, I'm not. I'm just
regular old G.
I'm just regular old G.
Yeah, I hear it's working fine.
It was totally fine.
Yeah. Cool.
Even when I had the laptop with iTunes downstairs and the TV upstairs and you know, and the access point somewhere in between, it was totally fine.
Excellent.
So I thought that was cool. I think it's step one.
Yep.
So limited in functionality. But if you have your entire media universe in iTunes, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's just awesome.
So what are the limitations that bother you? Not that we want to go into gear.
I just, it seemed like there was more that it could do. Like, you can't go to the store and buy stuff. You can't, it's not fully functioning iTunes. And you'd think, boy, you'd like to be able to sit there and go, well, what movies are available to buy? And I'll just buy them and then let them, while I'm buying them, they're streaming. And,
I see.
You know, you can imagine that being...
Whilst on the big screen experience.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Rather than having to go back to your laptop.
So, I mean, in some ways, the Windows Media Home Edition is better in that respect
because
it really is a full-featured OS mm-hmm. with what they call the 10-foot experience.
Yes,
you know,
okay.
Just a
10-foot
big
UI.
Screen, mm-hmm. big logos and button
big
UI
works.
And stuff. You know, my buddy Joe Belfiore over at Microsoft mm-hmm. was the guy who originally designed some of that stuff. And he's just a great UI designer.
No, it's a beautiful piece of work.
Cool, right?
Yeah.
And the way you connect it, instead of having the Apple TV thing, you get an Xbox.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about that. Like, that'd be great, you know, right off the Xbox.
Yeah. Perfectly legitimate.
I don't think so. I haven't done that because two problems. One, you know, it's a little bit of a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And two, my wife would kill me.
Oh, yeah. It's a bad one.
You know, have the Xbox in our bedroom. And I'd say,
oh, bedroom.
You know, oh, no, it's just a connector for the Windows, you know.
Yeah.
And she'd streaming. Say, no, no, you got to be kidding.
Yeah, you're going to be.
Put that, they can't, it's black and green and big X and.
Yeah.
Not happening. So not happening in my. Whereas the Apple thing's this pretty little silver box.
Yeah.
It's teeny and.
Yeah.
So I can get away with it. I had this Akimbo box for a while.
Hmm.
Really easy to set up and cool, but it basically had no content unless you really wanted lots of porn.
Oh.
You know.
Yeah. Not so, good for the bedroom.
Yeah. Or,
maybe.
Or otherwise.
Or otherwise.
My wife said, what is that? And I said, it's Kimbo. And she said, what's it good for? I said, pretty much a box of porn.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yes, put that away.
Yeah.
That needs to go, you know.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Was that your sales pitch?
Yeah,
because
yeah,
really
yeah.
Really, the Akimbo box is going.
It didn't work out.
You know, so. Yeah. But it's been an interesting evolution, right? Slingbox, Akimbo, you know, the Windows Media,
mm-hmm.
now the Apple TV. So I'm a believer. Always have been.
Well, you know, it's an iPod for your TV. Think of it that way. Don't think of it as its own thing. You know,
that's great.
Think of iTunes
respect,
as your central.
It was what, $300, $350?
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been $340 if I'd gotten a discount as an educator.
Well, there you go. God, that was really important.
Yeah.
Well, shameless plug. I got Scobalized.
He
had a list of the. He asked people what the best things to put on your Apple TV were, and Video Grunt got on there.
Oh, nice!
Which isn't bad because Video Grunt still actually I haven't up-resed it, so it's still the super small resolution, but it actually translates okay.
That'll look great.
Yeah,
so stuff translates pretty well.
Yeah, and I'll up-res the whole kit, so
it'll
look better. Yes, it's a question of how much you do it. Like, there's the Apple TV resolution, and then there's the maximum iPod resolution. So I'm waiting for the iPhone, then I'll really know the next spec.
Speaking of which, by the way, did you hear yesterday
FCC?
The FCC signed off?
Yeah.
I know you're a fanatic. You're sitting waiting.
With my
Craig
busted
literally
trio.
Yelled at me earlier because I've just bought a new Trio. What are you doing buying a Trio? The iPhone's almost here.
I spotted it across the room. I said, that paint is too fresh.
That's the Trio 755.
Well, don't get me wrong. Trio is the best thing out there, and that and the BlackBerry, they're doing great. But
you're waiting.
Why would you buy it now? Well, of course I am.
Because you're psycho.
I'm not made of money. No, I'm not made of money like you are, Mr.
20%
off.
I'm made of money. What's my? Do you think they'll have an educator discount on the iPhone?
They'll have a VC discount.
The VC. I know. I didn't want to mention that I was a venture capitalist. No, I'm a professor. See, it
right,
says.
Yeah, see?
It says, you know,
educator.
Right here on my Stanford ID, you can. All right.
Maybe yeah,
I won't use that discount next time.
No, well, that's okay. Just don't
Poor
tell
Apple.
Don't tell anyone about it.
Oh, okay. Well, no one will know. I'm sure no one listens to this, Craig. So we're probably safe. It's not illegal. It's perfectly legal and appropriate.
Of course, yeah. Let's talk legal and ethics, Mr. Lawyer / VC.
I don't think it's unethical.
It's not unethical. It's just kind of, you know.
All right. Whatever.
Who am I to say?
Whatever. You want me to pay double because I'm a VC?
No. I'm not in the tax the rich category. I'm just saying. Yeah, you're right. It's okay. You're a professor. That's honorable. You
I
know
am
what?
A professor.
You
professor
spend a lot
Hornick.
Of time doing that service that doesn't pay all that much, if anything.
Exactly.
And so there you go.
I'm trying to look out for America's youth.
If you hadn't said that, we would have gone on. We would have transitioned well. But now.
No, hey, listen. I mean, look, I'm even taking the time. I'm going to teach a class at Harvard Law School in the winter. I'm going to fly to Boston.
Another.
And hang out and talk with the future lawyers of America.
Oh, wow. That's touching. The future poverty lawyers going to Harvard.
Don't you think some of them are going to do poverty IP law?
Oh, yeah, right. They should work for Gonzalez. In fact, that whole class of 82 wrote him an open letter about his recent... Did you see that?
Dear sir,
dear
are you
sir,
out of your mind?
There's this document called the Constitution.
We like it. Could you stick with it a little bit?
Thought crime around copyright infringement. Have you followed that at all?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy. Totally ridiculous. Totally. So this is... So seriously, this is why I'm going... I'm co-teaching this class with John Palfrey, who runs the Berkman Center. And Palfrey's a great guy. He's really smart. And he is quite focused on bringing the realities of the web and web kind of architecture, infrastructure and all, and mixing that together with the law and legal theory and those things. And so he and I decided that it would be fun to talk about IP law and venture capital that context. So we're going to talk, you know, so it's going to be about being practical, making practical legal decisions, et cetera. So I think it's going to be, first of all, it's going to be fun. I really look forward to it. Secondly, I think it will be great for folks because I remember when I was there, you get very engrossed. not engrossed. You get very ingrained in the minutiae, details. You want to fight about little bits and pieces of the law.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to, it may make them crazy, but I'm going to say, step out.
Yeah,
you
let's
know?
Take a wider
See
view.
See this thing called the web?
Yeah.
It's actually the thing in which all these laws function.
Yeah.
And so let's think about it in that context. So.
No, I just think the work that the Berkman Center's doing, that Stanford's doing, and Berkeley, and the American University, I mean, this is all really great, very necessary stuff around copyright and IP. It's clearly, everyone's going crazy.
I met today with a group from Stanford called the Code X Group.
Hmm.
And it is the combination of law and engineering, computer science.
Okay.
So figuring out how to encode rules that are envisioned by laws in a more systematic way so that machines can strip away a bunch of the work around the applicability of zoning laws or the applicability of sets of, you know, various laws. And how can you use the semantics and semantic web to decrease the amount of difficulty in parsing these laws and those sorts of things. So really smart group of people, had a great conversation. I'm going to try and get involved over there if I can. And
was this related to your thing about creating the online
terms of service?
Yes.
Well, you know what? The interesting thing is that it wasn't.
Yeah.
It's just that I started chatting with these guys. I had been working with a group at the business school that were working on a thing called SIPIX, which was a standard IP protocol. And it was originally developed as part of this Codex group. So I met with them to talk with them. And when they described what they were doing, it was a perfect analog for this terms of service issue, which is breaking down what are the defining factors of a terms of service. And therefore, by describing the service you have, then automatically generating a terms of service agreement that reflects that service.
Yeah.
And so they are going to work with me on creating the final website.
Cool.
And so hopefully in the near future, we'll actually roll it out. Because it's a great thing, this idea that if you're a young entrepreneur and you're putting something out there, instead of just doing what you typically do, which is, oh, I'm going to go find a similar terms of service and just rip it off. Instead, you can actually describe the things you do and generate one that makes sense. And then instead of having to pay a lawyer a whole bunch of money to do it, maybe you pay a lawyer to review it.
To review
it. Say, does this make sense? They tweak it and you're done, right?
Right, but that's 3 hours instead of 30.
Hopefully it's an hour. I mean, maybe it's three if there's something that needs changing.
Yeah.
Right? And so, and it's, I'm not interested in putting lawyers out of work. On the other hand, you know, this isn't like the interesting, important stuff that lawyers are doing. This is the stuff that you have to do to protect yourself. So hopefully we can get that nailed and we can get the site. And when we do, I will happily announce where you can go.
Terms of service.
Terms of service generator. I don't know. I should start buying some URLs.
We didn't say anything. You didn't hear anything.
Forget about it.
Nothing.
Don't be buying that.
I'll edit that.
Neep. Oh, whatever Hornick said. www.ihavenoidea.com. All right.
You were at 35 minutes already.
Seriously?
Yeah, we just got going.
Oh, and you know what? My assistant, the lovely Mary, just gave me the look like,
I see it. That is the look.
You're done. In fact, you know, let's see if we can look across. Oh, no, they didn't put them in the...
My martini glass is still in the conference room.
That's right. See?
My martini glass is still in the
We gave, finally, gave Craig
martinis. After all of my ranting about not having martinis when I get here.
And
Mary gave me one today. It was a while back, so that's why my speech isn't slurred.
That's right. We took care of that. Well, that's
I want to give a shout to Greg Gallant
on
Venture Voice because he did, my notes are missing, but he did an interview with a gentleman who was one of the early guys in DoubleClick. And like this interview came out like the day after the announcement. It was like perfect timing. But just another shout out for Venture Voice. It's a great show.
Love Venture Voice.
Yeah, he's doing a great job. So,
you know, Craig, I didn't sing today, and that disappoints me.
I'm sure.
Are you looking for anything in particular?
No, it's fine. In fact, I think we need to wrap this up. And
now the time has come. All right, whatever. Final curtain.
Oh, My Way, right?
Yes, exactly.
Was that the Sid Vicious version?
Yeah, right, exactly. It wasn't even that good.
All right, we will roll because you have a meeting. It's been a pleasure.
As always.
Good to catch up, and we will see you. Oh, thanks to Cashfly, of course.
Cashfly, of course.
They rock.
And a couple weeks in between now and the next time we get together, I will go to the Wall Street Journal conference.
The D conference.
D, all things digital.
Yes. That's a couple weeks from now, right?
It's a week from Tuesday.
I'm going to try to get down there, too. It'd be fun.
Cool.
We'll see.
All right. Well,
it's in California.
If we sit around the Aviaris, it's held at the Four Seasons Aviaris.
Aviaris.
And San Diego, although it's to call it San Diego is kind of a is a stretch because it's in the middle of freaking nowhere.
Carlsbad.
Take drive and drive and drive. But anyway, we could just set up shop, hang out in the like in the lobby.
Be compelling.
In the, it like, but just, you know, instead this time we'll just sit around on couches. We won't chase people down. We'll let them come to us.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't that be good?
We should have some sort of swag to lure them in. We'll think of something.
Just we'll just give them, we'll just ply them with drinks.
Yes. And then promise that we'll speak highly of whatever they're doing on the podcast.
Right, exactly. And then we will brutally
diss them when they walk away.
Dismember their assertions of excellence. So those of you listening, be sure to stop by. That'll be festive.
All right.
See you there.
Enough damage.
All right, class. Before we go on with the next exercise, I'd like to make one of my little speeches. You're starting a new career. It can be fun, or it can be hard. It all depends on the way you look at things, your attitude. Treat others as you want to be treated. First, of course, know your job. Enjoy it. But also enjoy the people that you're working with. Be considerate of them. Remember those simple rules of office etiquette. And you'll get along in the business world.